there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails, and your calls, all on Ask Dr. Dawn, so don't touch that dial. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We're going to have a lot of interesting news, but I wanted to start with a couple of replies to the previous show. This from Sarah in Soquel. I appreciated today's discussion on lung health and coal mining. In it, you emphasize the importance of respirators to guard against black lung disease, and you acknowledge that respirators can be uncomfortable while exhorting miners to consider the dire consequences of foregoing them. Sarah then goes on to cite an April 16th report on the morning edition of NPR that noted that the respirators miners wear aren't just annoying, they tend to clog with dust and particles, making it impossible for the workers to breathe. The report suggested that there are potentially more effective alternative approaches to miners' health. For example, monitor silica and coal dust levels in the mines, enforce appropriately stringent maximum levels on periods miners spin underground, enabling them to breathe fresh air at regular intervals, and back off from the current feverish mine productivity rates that seem to have increased the impact of black lung in recent years. Well, Sarah goes on to draw the inevitable conclusions about putting worker health and safety over production. And as many of you are aware, there is, in fact, a criminal investigation going forward because of some concerns about the willful violation of worker health and safety. And I have to just revert back to my thinking on the subject of any kind of safety regulation or consumer protection regulation. Regulation is only as good as its enforcement. Another email from Hal Levin, who has a building technology and health and safety business. Dear Dr. Dawn, nice lesson, very clear, and from my perspective, properly oriented in terms of the human response to particulate air pollutants. One thing to add from my perspective, combustion produces fine particles that also serve as absorption sites for gases of low volatility. These include polyacetylated hydrocarbons in the case of combustion, and depending on the material that is burning, a variety of other gases with toxic and carcinogenic potentials, gases like dioxins and furans, which, due to their extremely low volatility, tend to be present primarily in the condensed phase. So the fine and ultrafine particles serve as vehicles for delivery of these toxic compounds into the deep lung tissue, where they can easily cross the barrier and enter the blood. In non-combustion situations, plasticizers, pesticides, and fire retardants are also of very low vapor pressure and will be found in dust and in particles collected from the air. And the bottom line on that, Hal, is that we want to limit our exposure as much as possible to these fine particulates. Our lungs are capable of dealing with a limited amount of this. In the case of things that actually reach the threshold of being considered medical diseases, these restrictive lung diseases generally related to scarring from too many particles, literally flooding the lung's ability to filter it. Hal raises the issue of things like fire retardants and dioxins, which are hormone mimics entering our bloodstream literally through inhaled particles. And that's a separate issue that is much more difficult to really frame as a disease. You can almost frame it as a wear and tear phenomenon in the sense that we all have exposures to various environmental pollutants, and we all have variable abilities in the part of our genetic endowment to process these pollutants. And so there will be people who are injured even by quote-unquote acceptable professional levels. And we need to just open our minds a little bit and understand that generally accepted as safe doesn't mean safe for everybody. But practically speaking, we may have to accept some level of risk in order to just get on with things. Oh, I have an errata from Hal. Sorry, Hal. Hal Levin is in Santa Cruz. That's where his business is based, not in Carmel or Monterey. And I want to apologize for that inaccuracy. Hal is definitely my free consultant go-to guy for environmental hazards. And if you think you might have a little environmental hazard going on, you can certainly throw him some business. One more email I wanted to be sure to get to. This one from Antonia in New York City. Antonia writes, my uncle, after being in the hospital first for diverticulitis and then for a deep cyst MRSA infection, ended up contracting a stubborn case of Clostridia difficile. I think he has been taking antibiotics on and off for about 6 months now, and this is the third time the C. diff has come back. And I think his doctors may be running out of solutions. My uncle has basically been confined to home indefinitely because of the terrible diarrhea. And it seems counterintuitive to me to treat something caused by an overuse of antibiotics with more antibiotics. So I'm hoping you might have some ideas about alternative treatments for C. difficile. I'd also like to know if you can recommend a functional medicine doctor in New York City. I did go on the functional medic site, but I'm having trouble choosing someone blindly. Antonia, I don't personally, on the top of my brain, come up with anyone, but I will do some research. And if I know anyone in New York after I've looked through the database, I will give you a private contact via email. With respect to alternative treatments for C. difficile, just a little background. C. difficile is an opportunistic infection that normally resides in the human intestinal tract. It is there at very low levels, and it is kept suppressed by the presence of all of the other probiotic bacteria, which are part of our natural internal ecology. Under the circumstance where a person takes large doses of antibiotics, the protection offered by the probiotics disappears, and the C. difficile, which is generally resistant to most antibiotics, has a chance to bloom. Well, this causes a rather severe toxic-related diarrhea, and there you have it. Well, in the best parlance of practical wisdom, fight fire with fire. So I am a great proponent of the use of probiotic bacteria and also protective yeast for the treatment of C. difficile. In the last 5 years in my practice, any patient who has this illness is strongly advised to use two different forms of probiotics, Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a yeast which has been shown in placebo double-blind studies to work for both ulcerative colitis and inflammatory bowel disease and for C. difficile. So I use that widely. I also suggest to people using at least two species each of various lactobacillus and bifidobacterium, and those are widely available. There is a interview in the archives with a Dr. Huffnagel that discusses all of the different uses of probiotics. Your dose on the lactobacillus and bifidobacterium is probably about 10 to 12 billion colony-forming units of four different species daily for the treatment of C. difficile. So I hope you find that helpful. Huffnagel's interview was June 9th, 2007. So if you're interested in looking at that, Antonia, you can go to askdrdawn.com and then hit the archives button and the interviews and scroll down to that. And I'd be very pleased if you would refer to that and perhaps send a link to your uncle's doctor there in New York. Because you know what? Doctors like data, and there's lots of good, hard scientific data in that interview. Let's go now to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I'm calling for two women who are 76 and 77 and have arthritis pretty bad, getting worse, and they have a friend who claims that creatine, an amino acid, does great wonders for that person and wants them to take the same thing. Is this safe to take, and do you think that there's any possibility that it does help?
Well, creatine is a component, a very large component of muscle. To my knowledge, at least, it's mainly been promoted to bodybuilders and people who were looking to improve their strength and endurance. I have not heard of its use in arthritis or osteoarthritis, so I'm afraid I'm going to come up blank there for you. In terms of its safety, the only real concern that I have when people take massive doses of any amino acid is that they not take it with their exclusive protein meal of the day. There are some people who eat very little protein, and I want to be sure that they absorb a balanced ratio of amino acids from the protein they consume taking a large dose of one amino acid can sometimes create a problem. An example would be, I'll often use L-arginine for lowering blood pressure or treating angina in patients who are looking for a natural treatment. This raises nitric oxide and opens up the blood vessels, which is good. But L-arginine is absorbed through the same mechanism as L-lysine. And L-lysine has been associated with keeping herpes infections at bay. So if I give people massive doses of L-arginine and they're taking it throughout the day, that could cause their L-lysine to drop. And it's been associated with the potential for causing a herpes outbreak in individuals who have that disease. So there's a lot of domino effect things going on in nutritional therapy. And the smart move is to just be sure that if you're going to megadose, you allow your other proteins to absorb normally, or your other amino acids, I should say.
Is there anything that you suggest in the way of supplemental food or pills for that outside of pain relievers?
Now, are you talking about osteoarthritis?
Yes.
Okay. So in terms of osteoarthritis, sulfur-containing compounds such as S-adenosylmethionine, which is SAMe, and MSM are associated with improved symptoms. I'm a great advocate of glucosamine sulfate because that has actual scientific, again, double-blind placebo data. And I like that kind of data, I have to admit. There isn't always available. When something has it, I'm very much on it. Glucosamine sulfate does have that level of evidence for osteoarthritis, so I'm very much encouraging anyone with that condition to use 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams a day of glucosamine sulfate, and also high doses of omega-3 fatty acids, which would be your fish oil, your EPA, your DHA, because these flood the arachidonic acid system with a form of substrate, building blocks, that makes for less inflammation. So you can literally down inflame someone by giving them enough fish oil. And I think in the case of osteoarthritis, which is an inflammatory condition, that makes just an enormous amount of sense. Plus, it might lower your risk of heart disease and lower your blood pressure. And what's wrong with that?
I'll pass this information on to them. And also, I'd like to make a remark about healthcare. I think if there was, you know, doctors in every area like you, who someone could call in who can't use the internet and things like that, and get information like you give out, I think that'd save a tremendous amount of money for the whole system.
Hey, maybe we should talk to President Obama and see if he'll create a, you know, a healthcare call center and staff it with physicians. I think that would be an excellent idea. Even if they just did conventional medicine and not the blended medicine that I do, it would still be a hugely good idea.
I'm going to write a letter, and I hope that some of your listeners will also write letters.
Why don't you carbon copy me on that letter, please? Okay, and we'll put it up on the website and encourage that.
Okay, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And my producer has gone on web and found lots of information about creatine, but mainly looking at bodybuilding and osteoporosis, not osteoarthritis. So just in terms of a good idea maybe for muscles and possibly osteoporosis as well, there's at least data on that. But in terms of osteoarthritis, big question mark. Claire in Watsonville writes, regarding vitamin D megadose, hello doctor, my doctor recently prescribed a one pill dose of vitamin D, 50,000 units. I neglected to ask him about the effects of such a large dose all at once on the system. Could you please tell me about the viability of taking this dose? I'm a bad pill taker, which is why a one-a-month dose is attractive to me. I'm at risk for osteoporosis. Thanks so very much for your show. Okay, Claire. When I started seeing the use of 50,000 units of vitamin D, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, and the endocrinologists were doing it for hyperparathyroidism, which is a condition where you have too much of a hormone that steals calcium from your bones. So it seemed really massive dose. And over the years, I've gotten used to seeing that dose. And the research, you know, a lot of other people kind of were freaking out at it too, and they've done research. And so far, I'd say there's no evidence of a problem with using that. And it's typically done weekly in people with hyperparathyroidism. So a monthly dose, really, if you do the math, that's only 2,000 units of vitamin D per day. And my concern with your taking that dose once a month is that, number one, you'll be taking it probably as vitamin D2, which is not as desirable as vitamin D3. I'm not aware of any pharmaceutical dose of vitamin D3 at 50,000 units. So I think you're not getting the best possible vitamin D there. And secondly, if you're a bad pill taker, I have a better idea for you. There are a number of companies that make a liquid vitamin D that comes in little droppers. And you could just put a drop of this very tasteless compound into something that you're eating or drinking on a daily basis. And I think that would be a more sensible approach, and it would get around your pill-taking issue. So I hope you'll consider that. In general, in people who are at risk for osteoporosis, I'm recommending that they get a vitamin D level checked and treat to a blood serum level of about 45. If you have autoimmune disease, such as lupus or multiple sclerosis, I'm currently recommending about 70. The research has been done showing that harmful effects of vitamin D do not occur at under a level of 100 in the blood. So there's nothing wrong with shooting for 70 or 45 for osteoporosis. And remember, one of the primary ways that vitamin D helps for osteoporosis is by improving the absorption of calcium. So if you take a lot of vitamin D but don't have enough calcium in your diet, you could still run into problems. Dairy food is a good source of calcium. Calcium supplements, of course, are designed to do that. But let's not forget broccoli, which has a good amount of calcium in it, particularly if you steam it, and is also got all kinds of wonderful cancer-preventing or cancer-fighting compounds. So all big pluses, and I hope you'll consider that. A couple things in the news this week that caught my attention, but I have to do the obligatory story on what's going on in healthcare reform, because that's become kind of the go-to topic. So this week in Congress, Congress passed legislation that would reinstitute rate review protections. So in other words, the final bill that got approved last month omitted, for quote-unquote procedural reasons, a clause that would allow the Secretary of Health and Human Services to, quote, review premiums and block any rate increase found to be unreasonable. This is extremely important because between now, 2010, and when the rate control legislation kicks in 2014, there's plenty of wiggle room for the actuaries at health insurance plans to take a look at people, troll their old medical records for family history, for example, and reassign a risk status to a person, not based on anything that's happened to their health, but rather on something that might happen in the future. So without this particular legislation in place, or I should say regulation in place, it would be very easy for one of the Blues or one of the other large companies to say, you know, we've reconsidered. Your mother had breast cancer. We're going to bump you to a much higher premium because you might get breast cancer in the future. And now that healthcare reform is coming down the line, we want to be sure we raise your rates now while we can still do it. And I have to tell you, I'm not putting that kind of thing past them, because that's the dynamic, right? The health insurance companies frame their job as to stay in business and make a profit for shareholders. And, oh yes, by the way, provide a healthcare safety net for the public. And their priorities are in that order. No profit margin, no company, and no company, no corporation has ever voluntarily committed suicide. So we need that regulation, and I'm glad to see it come in. And let me take a moment and talk about this concept of personalized medicine. You're going to be hearing a lot about this from me. And it's an outgrowth of the idea of functional medicine, which is that people are biochemically unique and that we need to assess and identify these variances in people and address our healthcare towards these variances. In other words, working with the strengths and working around the weaknesses. And I alluded to something like that earlier in terms of the differences that people may have in their ability to process environmental toxins. Well, the same thing is true in terms of just risks for various diseases. And while the healthcare insurance companies may be looking at that as a way to exclude people, as a physician, I'm looking at that as, potential trouble ahead. How can I help steer around that particular iceberg in the dark that might be waiting out there in this person's future? And the answer is personalized medicine. Two recent studies are going to really change the kind of advice that I start giving out as I embark on my first baby steps in doing personalized medicine in my regular primary care practice. This first study is a large-scale trial enrolling 20,000 postmenopausal women over the age of 35 who had an above-normal risk of breast cancer, either because they had breast cancer genes or a family history of the disease. This study was done at the MD Anderson Cancer Center of Houston, and you can look for a link to this reference when I find it, but the chief author is Hortobagy. I'll spell that, Hortobagyi. Now, that's a name you can search with confidence that you're going to find the article. In any event, this trial showed that tamoxifen and raloxifen, which are both selective estrogen reuptake modulators, cut breast cancer risk in half in high-risk women. Now, you heard about raloxifen in this context almost 5 years ago, if you're a regular listener to the program. This was based on earlier data that suggested a very strong preventative improvement. But this is a really good study. They showed that 5 years of raloxifen, which is sold under the trade name Evista as an anti-osteoporosis drug, reduced the risk of new cases of breast cancer by 50% in these women. So anyone with that kind of high risk of breast cancer who reaches menopause is now going to be hearing from me that they should consider taking a SERM so that they can get their risk down to at least the general population risk. This other study, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, March 17th, volume 303, looked at vitamin B6 and the risk of colon cancer. Now, for a while, vitamin Bs and colon cancer have been linked. This study was a meta-analysis, and they went back and looked at a total of 13 studies of either vitamin B6 intake or studies looking at blood pyridoxal 5-pyrophosphate, which is the active form of vitamin B6 in the bloodstream. And what they found was that the people who were in the highest 25% of either vitamin B6 intake or, and this was a stronger data point, the highest 25% of blood levels of pyridoxal 5-phosphate had a much lower, practically cut in half, the risk of colon cancer. So where I'm going to go with this in my personalized medicine approach now is I'm going to say to myself and to my patients, history of atypical polyps, history of ulcerative colitis, family history of colon cancer. Well, we're going to measure your blood level of pyridoxal 5-prime phosphate, and we're going to get it up to 150 picomoles per liter. Remember that number, 150 picomoles per liter. At that level and above, the risk of colon cancer was drastically lower, cut in half. That's a significant improvement, particularly in a high-risk individual. Do we want to do these sorts of measurements for everybody? Do we want to put everyone on vitamin B6 and everyone on raloxifen for breast cancer? Well, then you get into the problem that there's no one-size-fits-all medicine. And for the general population, you don't know necessarily that the risk of the disease is high enough to justify it until you've done that study. But what we do know is in high-risk individuals, there's enormous benefit, and those are the people we should be targeting first. Then, as they take these drugs long-term or these high doses of vitamins long-term, we can see what problems might crop up because we're interfering with their physiology to a certain extent. We get to see what's going on, what we might be doing wrong. In the meantime, those individuals who had a lot to lose have gained something valuable. And then we can figure it out. We can do the risk-benefit analysis with appropriate data. So it's going to be a process. And yes, you're going to see contradictory things and contradictory studies, because you have to look behind the headlines at the details to understand medical news stories. And I hope that I'm successful at providing you with exactly that sort of information. And let's go now to Inez in Monterey. Inez, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Dawn. I have a question about Ambien.
Go ahead.
When you take it for several years, 5 milligrams a night, we were looking in the internet and found out all the side effects from it, trying to get off of it, and it's been 6 days now where we've alternated it, but we didn't know if that was the right thing to do because it's really dangerous.
Well, let's put the dangerous in perspective, because Ambien has this vicious small group of heavily involved internet people who are just so totally against it and tell these absolute horror stories of, you know, I found myself lying on the floor of the kitchen with turkey smeared all over my face kind of stories that just are incredibly creepy. It's kind of like the vaccine group. It's a little bit of overkill, and we all need to take a deep breath and get a little rational here. That being said, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. And if you take a sleeping pill like Ambien or Valium or a barbiturate or anything that's active in the central nervous system, and you take it every day, well, Mother Nature fights back. Your central nervous system will actually change and alter its thresholds and its neurotransmitters and various other things, such that you won't sleep very well at all for days and days when you suddenly stop the agent cold turkey. Now, Ambien is not nearly as bad as the Valium group of drugs, but it does have the potential for tolerance, and that's probably what you've begun to experience. And now when you have tolerance and you stop the agent, you have withdrawal. Typically, in the use of Ambien, what I have found has worked really well over the years, and I've probably been doing this for 20 years now, or no, maybe 15, is I'll tell people, you get to take it 3 days in a row, and then on the fourth day, you suffer. You don't take it. And doing it that way, my patients have been able to avoid tolerance for long periods of time. So I only give them 22 pills a month, so they can't take it for the entire month. And that's been a really good strategy. Of course, it's gotten me in trouble because the pharmacies are used to 30 pills, but that's a different story. However, on that fourth night, I've either told people suffer, or if they absolutely can't do it, I've given them a different agent that has a different mechanism of action so that they don't get tolerant through continued use of the agent. Once someone comes in who's been on it for a very long time and has developed tolerance, essentially what you have to do is cross-titrate. So I'll try various agents. One of my go-to drugs is something called trazodone, which is an old-fashioned antidepressant. It was never a very good antidepressant because it made people too sleepy. Get it? So it's a good sleeping pill. And it's cheap and it's generic, which all good. I don't see a lot of tolerance with that over long-term use, which is another interesting thing, is that some drugs cause tolerance more readily than others, and it has to do with individual biochemistry as well as just general across-the-board biochemistry. So I use that drug, trazodone, often if I'm trying to get someone off of Ambien. And then I also always try the herbs. I try high doses of magnesium, passion flower, valerian, chamomile. Sometimes these work better in combination. Usually with a motivated patient, and I have to add, some people are just, doctor, shut up and give me a prescription. You know, I don't want to hear it. I'm too busy. I can't be bothered. My mother's dying. My kid has cancer. You know, I'll concentrate on myself later. Just help me through this. And that's fine. You know, people are here for help, and if they can accept whatever help I have to give them, great. And if they want a different kind of help, as long as it's within my realm of, oh, I guess we'll call it ethics, sure, what the hell. But in your case, you're asking, how can I get off of this? So I would go out and I would get magnesium glycinate, some valerian, some passion flower, and some chamomile, and you can get those in combinations. And I would see if you could drop the dose of Ambien, cut them in half, and take the herb and sleep. And then after a couple of weeks of that, I would drop the dose of the Ambien again and stay on the herb and see if you can gradually taper yourself off. You may not sleep as well for a couple of weeks, but I think eventually you can get off this agent.
Boy, that sounds great. Yeah, that's a wealth of knowledge there.
Yes, and it's on the website, so you don't have to worry. This will be posted by Monday. You can go to AskDrDawn.com, and you can download a recording of this that you can listen to on your computer, or if you don't have a computer, you can get someone to do this for you and put it on a CD, and then you can listen to it and take notes, okay?
That sounds great.
All right, well, good luck to you, Ines.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And just a little comment, I neglected to mention melatonin, which is it's basically a health food, quote-unquote, nutritional supplement, but actually it's an analog of a hormone that your body makes in the brain in a gland called the pineal gland, which is responsible for your sleep and wake cycle. High-dose melatonin is being used in some sorts of conditions for certain cancer therapies, for autoimmune disease, for sarcoidosis, and we're not talking about high-dose melatonin here. We're talking about 1 to 3 milligrams. Oddly enough, the 1 milligram dose often works better than the 3 milligram dose, and it is available at health food stores. There are really no health concerns for the use of melatonin at these low doses, and in fact, there's a very expensive pharmaceutical that is based on, essentially, it's a synthetic analog of melatonin that can be marketed as a pharmaceutical because being a natural substance, melatonin can't be patented. So I'd say that we can consider this to be a safe and useful agent for sleep. I haven't found it terribly useful in people who are having to get off Ambien, however, I must say. In that circumstance, I usually need to go to some of the other therapies that I've suggested. This has come up a couple of times in my practice in the last few years. A daughter or a son will come in and say to me, I'm really worried about my mom. I don't think she should be driving. She's getting a little foggy in the head, and I'm worried that she's going to hurt herself or hurt someone else. What do I do? And indeed, this is a very difficult problem. Doctors can write to the DMV and suggest that a license be pulled, but the DMV doesn't always act on those letters. And there is great resistance both on the part of the Department of Motor Vehicles because of the cost and on the part of voters because a disproportionate number of voters are older people and they don't want to have the government taking away their driver's license. So the idea of instituting a requirement, let's say that anyone over the age of 80 take a driver's test, an actual physical driving test, has never really gotten much traction, although I think it should be considered. The American Academy of Neurology just issued new practice parameters for physicians that take account of the most recent findings on cognitive impairment, and this document has not been updated for over a decade. Briefly, what it says is that the physician should perform a mini mental status exam. And if the person has mild dementia on that score, they need to take into account their past driving record and his or her level of aggressiveness and impulsiveness and insight. So basically, a person's driving record, how many accidents they've been in, how many tickets they have, is a good indicator of their basic skill. And some people don't become skilled drivers. The second thing is personality. Aggressiveness and impulsiveness are qualities that can be assessed. And if the person is highly aggressive or highly impulsive, that's not a good quality in a driver at any age. And with the addition of mild dementia, that might be a reason to pull. The third reason is insight. And if you talk to elders, and I have several in my home, and I can tell you, that an elder with insight will start modifying what he or she will do, avoiding dangerous behaviors, staying off the freeway, not driving at night, not driving in traffic, things like that. And of course, a retired person has the option to stay away from certain circumstances and take the scenic route. So when the insight is absent, it does become incumbent on the family to act. And you have to frame this in terms of a safety issue for all. It doesn't make it any easier, but I do think that these new guidelines published by the American Academy of Neurology at least give physicians a sort of legal leg and just a little bit of psychological boost in terms of taking the time and making the intervention and framing this as part of their duty, not just to protect their patient, but also to protect those who might come in contact with their patient. Let's talk to Chuck in Monterey. Hello, Chuck, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I've got a question about vitamins.
Go ahead.
And I've heard that some stores or places sell things like CQ10, and some of the brands don't have all the things they should have in it. And I get ads in the mail from Swanson or Puritan's Pride and places like that, and they have good deals, like buy two, get three free, and mm-hmm. I just wonder how you know which ones are the best ones to buy.
Well, the absolute best vitamins to buy are the ones that are tested independently by testing agencies. And some of the companies that I use, I mean, if I'm going to recommend something, I'm always recommending fairly high-end when there's an issue, for example, with CoQ10, when there's an issue about absorption. But you have to pay for that inspection. And if you go to the company's website or call or ask for their literature, they will tell you if they're being inspected by one of these entities. There's also a web company called consumerlab.com that one can subscribe to. I subscribe it. I think it costs me $20 to $30 a year. And they will go out to a health food store and just buy everything on the shelf that's a CoQ10, for example. And then they'll take it back to their lab and they'll test it. And they'll test it on the same sorts of criteria that the FDA uses for generic drugs, which are it has to be within 5% of the milligrams it says it is, plus or minus 5%. And that's a pass. It has to be free of contaminants. And so Consumer Lab tests for lead, tests for pesticides, things that would hurt you if you were ingesting them every day. And it tests, does it have in it what it says it has, and does it have something else? For example, if you go and you buy an herbal sleep aid and you buy a cheap one, you may actually be buying something like diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl, which is very cheap. And if you grind up antihistamines and put them in your herb, the people will sleep a lot better because antihistamines are sedating. But that's not why you're buying the herb. You're buying the herb because you want to get a natural fix for your insomnia. If you wanted Benadryl, you'd go buy Benadryl. So that's sleazy. And if you buy things that have been vetted by Consumer Lab, then you don't have that problem. And they test the major brands. So your Puritan's Pride and your Life Extension and your, what's that general nutrition center that you see in all the malls? So that's a good watchdog organization. And because it's paid for by subscribers, it's kind of the Consumer Reports of drugs. And by the way, Consumer Reports does periodically do exactly that. And they have a nice website. So if you're interested in that, you can usually buy the article for the particular substance. I think they sell their content. I don't think you can get their content for free. But you can at least find out if they have good content. And these are entities that make their living by being impartial and doing the testing.
Well, that's the way to go, then.
Yes, it is.
And that's and you said consumerlabs.com.
That's right. And okay. I believe we have a link to them on the AskDrDon.com website.
Okay.
Do your research.
Yeah, I see. Okay, well, thanks a lot for the information.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, this one's pretty cool. Comes off of CNN.com. Killer fungus seen in the Pacific Northwest. So there's a new, rare, but life-threatening tropical fungus that we need to put on our Dr. House differentials when patients show up with a cough. It's called Cryptococcus gatti, G-A-T-T-I-I. And starting in Oregon and Washington over the last 5 years, it's infected dozens of humans and animals. 18 cases in people between 2005 and 2009. 18 cases in people doesn't sound like such a big deal, but the symptoms include chest pain, persistent cough, shortness of breath, fever, and weight loss. In other words, it looks like tuberculosis. It has been known to cause meningitis. It does respond to antifungal drugs. And it started out in 1999 in Vancouver Island off the coast of British Columbia. The new one that has headed south and is now in Oregon and Washington appears to have mutated, and it's a bit more virulent. It's killed about 25% of the identified cases. Of course, we don't have a true denominator, because in people who don't get very sick, you're not going to look for very weird Dr. House-style bugs, and so who knows how many cases there have actually been in this area. Nevertheless, something to put in your hat as a differential if a person has a persistent cough. And, you know, if you're coughing for 3 or 4 months, particularly if you have fevers and weight loss, you should encourage your doctor to refer you to an infectious disease specialist. Weight loss and night sweats in particular are a big red flag. And just if you test negative for tuberculosis, well, that's nice. I'm happy. But it doesn't mean that you don't have something that's infectious and should be checked. Interestingly, the Bush-era prohibition on the use of embryonic stem cells may actually have been a blessing in disguise. For years, the promise of stem cells was stymied by restrictions in federal funding on the use of embryonic stem cell lines. This forced a lot of bright minds and researchers who probably would have stayed with embryonic stem cells to branch out and start looking at the possibility of taking adult stem cells and converting them back into embryonics. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know about epigenetics, and essentially that's the difference between an embryonic stem cell and an adult stem cell, is that an embryonic stem cell has less accumulated epigenetic change. The metaphor I always like to use is taking a paperclip and closing a few pages in a book such that they can't be read. Well, that's how epigenetic change slowly narrows down the potential of a stem cell to become just a regular body cell like a fibroblast. And it turns out that's a two-way street. Researchers at the University of Miami Medical School have been doing something really interesting with adult stem cells. They've taken adult stem cells from bone marrow. These are mesenchymal, that's the germ layer that builds muscles, mesenchymal stem cells. And they have been able to turn those cells into an adult stem cell that can then be injected into a vein in a person who's had a heart attack. And the stem cells actually home in on the injured heart muscle, probably because there are chemicals being excreted into the bloodstream by the injured heart muscle. And the stem cells actually follow that gradient and find the heart muscle where they take root and grow and then develop into cardiomyocytes. So they become heart muscle cells after being just generalized cells at the time of injection. This is really, really interesting. And there's another study that they're getting ready to do where they're going to inject stem cells into the spinal column in individuals who have spinal column transections. These are human studies, I want to emphasize. So we have already jumped to human studies in order to try and treat some of these diseases, which are otherwise, just by our current level of technology, live with it kinds of diseases. Interestingly enough, a group called the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis along these lines is working not with stem cells, but with Schwann cells. Schwann cells, that's S-C-H-W-A-N-N, are the cells that make myelin. And they wrap themselves around, they stretch out really thin, and they wrap around the nerve cells, and they create the insulation that allows a nerve cell to function most rapidly. Well, they've injected stem cells that they extracted from muscles in the arms and legs into the spine, into the spinal column, the CSF, and they've been able to show some preliminary help in getting these to turn into myelin and sort of patch the myelin sheaths in the transected portion of spinal column. Now, this is just electrologic data at this point, so they're getting some signals across. It isn't much, and it isn't enough to restore a paralyzed person. But between this and the stem cell research, we're starting to see some really promising stuff. And like I said, because you're using adult stem cells, you have an unlimited supply of those in the individual's own body. Now, this is going to cost literally an arm and a leg in terms of the therapy. So we still want to put our energy and time into preventing these diseases. But in cases where an individual is looking at a lifetime of paralysis, having the social resources to restore that person's ability to walk is the kind of medical miracle that I think we all want to invest in as a society, even though only a very, very small percentage of us will ever benefit directly from some technology like that. Let's go to Owen in Monterey. Hello, Owen, and welcome to the program.
I have a pain right in the center of my chest. It's not my heart. My heart is pretty good, but the bone, I can feel it right in the bone. And once in a while, I feel it in the back. Once in a while, it seems to hit some bones in the back, and it's nowhere else in the chest, and it's in the direct center. My posture isn't that good. Once in a while, pain in the back.
Okay, so let me ask you a few questions. Age?
Yeah, I'm over 70.
All right. Have you ever had any kind of cancer?
Yes.
What kind?
Prostate.
Okay. The reason I'm asking those two questions is because when a person who's an elder gets bone pain, and it sounds like you're describing pain in the sternum, it's really important to make sure that that isn't a late recurrence of cancer. Now, the probability is that it's something else, but you always have to think about what will kill the patient. So it's important that you have that ruled out. There is a blood test that's fairly accurate in looking for bone metastasis. It's called acid phosphatase. Your doctor can order it from the regular lab. You want to be sure that level is normal. It would be reasonable to get an x-ray of your sternum or your breastbone. The other thing on the what will kill the patient category would be cardiac. And the questions I would ask to try and figure out, is this a heart pain? Do I need to be worried about it being a heart pain? Would be things like, can you push on the pain and make it worse and reproduce the pain? So can you?
Yeah, I can.
Good. That's a plus. The second question is, when you're exercising or when you become excited or nervous, does the pain flare?
Not necessarily.
Okay, so that's a maybe. That's an equivocal one. A good solid no would be a better answer, but if the answer is maybe sometimes under some circumstances, it doesn't prove much one way or another. It's important that cardiac disease be excluded, so something like a stress echocardiogram at your age anyway is not such a bad idea. And for chest pain, for the what we call the evaluation and management of chest pain, a stress echocardiogram would be an appropriate test. It would be covered by Medicare, probably wouldn't be looking at a significant personal expense to do it, and I think that would be a good idea. Now, what is it probably? Probably it's mechanical pain of the sternum, and that, as I said, once you've ruled out the bad stuff, the treatments for that are things like, first of all, looking at the posture, seeing if you can strengthen muscles in the back and stretch muscles in the front of the chest, because those will often help alleviate this kind of pain. So some stretching exercises and some strengthening exercises might be in your future.
Why is the chest in the sternum? Why doesn't it spread to the other parts of the chest?
Because it isn't. And we do see people with isolated pain in the sternum related, I guess, to just how the pull is on the chest wall. Now, all of your ribs are hinged off of that sternum. And if the muscles are yanking on a rib, you can get pain in that one joint, and it will reflect to the center of the sternum in some cases.
I do get pain in the rib, in the back sometimes.
Right, and that's where the other end of the hinge is. Think of a bucket handle. You know, you've got the two places on the bucket, in the front and on the back, and the sternum is one side of the bucket and the spinal column is the other. And every time you breathe, the bucket handle goes up about an inch and comes down about an inch. And that's just, you know, the movement that expands and contracts your chest does that.
So, oh, I see.
So you can see how you might get fatigue at one or the other of those joints.
I see.
Plus, the front and the back joint are connected on the same nerve. And so if you're irritating a nerve in the front, you'll often feel the irritation in your brain as if it were coming from the back. That sort of confusion is common. You hit your elbow and your hand hurts, right?
Right.
Yeah, like that. Because the brain only knows the nerve is hurting. It doesn't really know where along the nerve the stimulation came from.
Yeah, what is the name of that first test for cancer?
Acid phosphatase.
Acid phosphatase. Just a simple blood test.
Just a simple blood test. I should think an x-ray might be called for as well. But an x-ray is difficult to be sure. You have a doctor, right?
Yeah, sorta.
Sorta?
Well, yeah.
Okay, well, go to your sorta doctor. Is it that you sorta have him or he's a sorta doctor? I'm teasing you. Anyway, go to your doctor, remind him that you had prostate cancer, tell him about the pain, ask for a referral for a stress echocardiogram, and ask him, could this be my prostate cancer? And, you know, can we make sure it isn't?
Yeah, your doctor's... the numbers on the prostate cancer have been going down rapidly. I'm only at 1.1.
That's wonderful, but that's not evidence. Because unfortunately, if cancer spread, sometimes when they spread, the cancer mutates more, and it loses the ability to produce the marker that we're watching.
Oh, I see.
So it actually forgets how to make that epigenetic stuff again. It forgets how to make the PSA, and so it's no longer reliable. I mean, it's a good marker, but it's not 100% reliable, and you don't use it as a rule out if you've got symptoms that are suggestive. You really have to check the thing itself.
I see. Well, thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And just a suggestion off air from a listener that our last caller should think about learning to breathe with the belly, do diaphragmatic breathing and not necessarily so much chest breathing. That's a good idea. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I've certainly enjoyed it a lot, so I hope you'll join me next week for more questions and answers, debate, dialogue, and discussion, and answers to your email here on Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.